they might have had, say, a million products that they wanted to load into our system. And then they might have had, say, 200 users. And we put everything in. And then all these users logged on to then start setting up all their agreements. And the whole system just sort of crashed. I remember on a Friday, the top people sort of yelling down the phone saying, this has to be fixed by Monday because we've got all these people allocated to put this on. And this is a disaster. And my technical guys were saying, this is going to take about 6 weeks to fix.
Welcome to the Product Market Fit Show, brought to you by Mistral, a seed stage firm based in Canada. I'm Pablo. I'm a founder turned VC. My goal is to help early stage founders like you find product market fit. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hi, Pablo. Great to be here.
So I'm really excited to hear about kind of your journey at Enable. I mean, I'm looking here on Crunchbase. Anybody can see this stuff. But since March 2020, you've really been like on the venture train. I mean, every year you're raising, you know, 17, then 45, then 94, then 120 million. So every single year, it's a bigger round, which is like from the outside looking in, everything looks like perfection. Everything looks like it's going exactly as you planned it. But, you know, it took a while even just to get. I'm sure that's not reality. And also it took a while to kind of get there. You started, from what I can see, in around 2016, and you were running another business before that. So maybe just to start, like if you could set some context into what things were like when you started Enable, how you even started Enable kind of in the first place.
Absolutely. No, I'm very happy to. So yeah, I've always wanted to run my own company. You know, my father was an accountant, like a CPA in the UK, and he advised small businesses. And so I always wanted to start my own business. And my passion in life was technology and building applications. So as a kid in the 90s, late 90s, I was kind of building web applications and websites and all that kind of stuff. So I started my first business as a teenager in the 90s. And really, that was just services, just helping people out, helping small businesses, you know, building bespoke custom software for them. And that kind of grew. And then I met my co-founder, who really helped me to build that business. And we got to maybe 100 engineers over the course of quite a few years. And it was kind of profitable and, you know, literally selling hours to build software. So that was the core business. Some of our customers were kind of, you know, businesses that were asking us to write software for them, but others were actually software companies or people that had software ideas, and they wanted to outsource the engineering to us rather than do it themselves. So we were kind of building other people's products for them and seeing how successful some of those became, and really wanted to build our own product, you know, not rather than just building products for other people. We wanted to kind of build our own product. So I'll pause for a minute, but that was kind of the backdrop to what we then built in Enable.
And to be clear, you were building like what sort of, I mean, was it websites? Was it like full-on products? Like what was the main things that you were doing?
I would call it web applications, which of course these days we wouldn't bother with because everything's web. But back then, you know, early 2000s and so on, then a lot of software was still client-server. So it was web applications, and it was kind of data management and process management for a whole range of different things. You know, one of our big customers that we actually ended up investing in and built and sold to private equity eventually was all about health and safety and property management and compliance and that type of thing. So we were building kind of software platforms that would manage information and data.
You know, you mentioned you wanted to kind of build your own product, and I see this often, like people have a services business, and, you know, services, like the challenge, I mean, you tell me, but what I hear is, you know, you're always after that next customer, you're always after that next project, and you know, having a product where it can be more recurring, more predictable, many people are after that. Were you constantly working on different product ideas through that journey?
Yeah, we were. So, you know, in the early days, we were kind of building websites, and then we actually developed a content management system. And this was, again, very early before content management really existed.
What year was this?
Oh, like 2001 or something like that, 2002. So going back a long time. And that was an example of a product. And then we built something which was like a web-based database in those early years as well, and several things. But we didn't really focus on any particular one because we were driven by customer revenue and customer payments. And so we'd have to just build the next thing, whatever the next customer wants us to build.
Where would you say the story of Enable really begins?
So I think what we found is from those very early years, so as early as, you know, 2001, 2002, one of the common requirements that came up where people would come to us and ask us to build software was to actually manage rebates. And my co-founder was running a large distribution company in the UK. And so he was very well connected with other distributors, manufacturers, buying groups, you know, lots of people in the supply chain. And they all had these different forms of rebates. And you know, we came to understand this was a huge part of their profitability. So we were kind of building, again, custom software, which would meet their particular requirements. And we did this for quite a few years. So I'd say by around, say, 2010 or something like that, it was clear that there was a real need in the market for a rebate management product because we just kept building them on a bespoke basis.
By the way, let's just go layman's terms here, like grade three level. Walk me through the world of rebates, which is a bit esoteric, not something the average person thinks about much.
Sure, absolutely. So if you imagine how the supply chain works, 80% of global trade goes from a manufacturer through middle parties like distributors, buying groups, retailers, contractors, and then eventually to the end customer. That's 80% of trade. There's very, very little that goes direct from a manufacturer to an end customer. Apple and Tesla might be two examples, but you know, virtually everything else goes through the supply chain. And there are trading agreements between those supply chain partners. So a manufacturer will have agreements with distributors, distributors have agreements with retailers, and so on. Those agreements have lots of goals and objectives. So it says we want to sell this many products, you know, certain value, certain volume to certain end customers and all sorts of other conditions. And then when those goals are met, the manufacturer will actually pay money to the distributor and the distributor will pay money to the retailer. So it's like a pay for performance. So it's just like in a software company, you pay the sales team a commission. Rebates are just like sales commissions really in the supply chain, and they're all about driving behavior.
Money flows both ways, because let's just take the example of, we just did an episode last week about selling on couches online, right? So let's take couches, right? Like, manufacturer of couches obviously gets an order from a distributor who then gets an order from a retailer. So the money flows that way. But what you're saying is when certain objectives are met, money then flows the other way in the form of commissions.
Yes, and you're right. And the way we do actually define a rebate, you know, what is a rebate? Is a rebate is any funds that flows back through the supply chain. So like you say, everyone understands that we pay our suppliers, and you know, but this is where our suppliers actually pay us. So anything where our suppliers pay us is a rebate.
And so what are some of the key problems that you're seeing, you know, in the 2010s, you know, 2015 area, right before you start Enable, around managing rebates? Like, what's so hard about it?
So what was hard about it is, if you're a distributor, you will have rebates coming in from many, many different suppliers, and they will all be completely different because they're typically created by the manufacturer, although not always, and you'll be distributing many types of products. So if you're a construction company, you will be distributing kind of bits of lumber and, you know, wood. You'll be distributing HVAC systems and boilers. You'll be distributing kind of concrete and, you know, powder. And there's so many different types of products. So every manufacturer has different rebates with different units of measure. You know, some of them might be, will pay you $10 per kilogram or $10 per ton or $10 per unit. And then there's different tiers. And so it's really complex. And also commercial teams get very creative, just like they are today. So buyers come up with all kinds of strange, weird and wonderful mechanisms that say, well, you know, if you're selling to this customer and it's this particular product, but you're not selling this other thing, then you can get this, but only if, you know, so you can imagine. There was no software that could do that. And all these companies were using spreadsheets to manage what was becoming all of their profit. So that was the problem.
Who in the supply chain is using this? Is it more the manufacturers who are giving out these rebates, or is it like the distributors and the retailers that are receiving it?
So where we started was with the distributors. So it was distributors receiving this. But then what we quickly learned is distributors belong to buying groups, and buying groups negotiate these agreements on behalf of lots of distributors. So we then started actually providing software to buying groups as well. And then we actually found the manufacturers were equally struggling to manage it from the other way around. So then we started supplying manufacturers. So we now supply the entire supply chain, but it started from the distributor perspective.
Got it. Okay. So give me a bit of a timeline here. Like, when do you start really moving from consulting, and how do you do that transition, like from consulting to, you know, effectively a single product, SaaS, you know, the classic model?
It was very, very slow at first. And the services business was, like I said, profitable. We hadn't raised any investment. And it was providing, you know, fairly nice lifestyle.
And just so I understand, that services business, was that also strictly focused on rebates at that point? Or were you doing everything?
Okay. We were just building. But it, yeah, that was a common theme of something we were building, but we were building lots of other things as well. It was a kind of comfortable business. We could see it would never be huge because it was just growing steadily. And like you said, you have to always worry about where's the next customer, and you're just selling time. So it's finite. And then it was probably somewhere like 2013 where we said, right, we should actually build a product. And it was actually inspired by a Silicon Valley tour. So my co-founder and I came to Silicon Valley for the first time ever and met companies like Intel, Citrix, Google, startups. You know, DocuSign was an early startup back then. I remember meeting the founder, and we thought, wow, you know,
what brought you to the Valley? In that,
we just had contacts locally who had contacts in the Valley, and they organized this study tour for usually CIOs, like UK CIOs, that would they bring over to meet Silicon Valley companies. So that was quite inspiring. And so, for example, we came up with a product name in Silicon Valley in about 2013, and we got a website and a domain name. But it still was slow going, and we were still mostly focused on the core business. So I would say when we actually started writing code was probably 2015 or something, 2014, 2015. And then the official kind of launch date of the product was 2016.
Walk me through a little bit more of that Silicon Valley tour, because I, you know, there's people listening from all around the world, and it's harder to find, but you know, when I went through, I went to 500 Startups Accelerator. This is a while ago. I mean, but I guess similar era, it was like 2013, 2014. There's something different about the Valley. I don't know how much you remember of that trip, but clearly it inspired you at least to some extent. Like, what was it that happened during that trip? What did you feel that was different there versus in your startup ecosystem in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I guess as a Brit, you know, I've always found Americans very upbeat and positive and, you know, can-do attitude. And so that just struck me in general. And I think the approach to building a software company is just totally different here to certainly how it used to be in the UK. And I think the UK and other parts of the world are changing, by the way. So they're catching up. But I think in the UK, the approach was you've got to grow out of profits, which always means growth is very slow, because if you make $10, you can spend $9 on the product, and then eventually you might make $20, and then you can spend, you know, 15, but it'll take 100 years to actually build a global company like that. Whereas the Valley, once there's real belief and conviction and proof points that this has got the potential to be massive, then there's a huge appetite to invest.
It's similar, actually, just that difference between, like, I guess the UK and Valley and, you know, Canada and the Valley. And I remember back when we went, this is a different era, so the numbers aren't, you know, the same as today, but like, we were here in Canada raising at like a $2 million valuation or something like that. And we got into 500 Startups, and day one was fundraising 101. What the speaker was telling us was all about just hyper confidence. It was like, you got to go home today, you got to look yourself in the mirror, and you got to believe that you're worth $7 million. Right? That was just the attitude of, you've got to be hyper aggressive, which was so different to what we were used to, like in our ecosystem. And you're right, things are, let's say, kind of coming together a little bit more, converging a little bit more worldwide. But still, like, there's just more willingness to just go for it, I think, in the Valley in general.
Exactly. So I think that was inspiring. But I never thought at that point that I would end up, for example, moving here and raising money in the Valley. That never occurred to me back in 2013. But it was just an inspiring visit that kind of reminded my co-founder and I that we must, you know, get on and launch our own products.
And how, like, just so I understand the scale of it, like, because it's also really hard to give something up that's working, even if it's not exploding. Like, how many employees did you have at that time, 2013, 14, 15? How much revenue were you bringing in on the services side?
Well, I would say we were probably at, say, 5 million of revenue or something. And we probably had about, say, 40 or 50 people. That was the kind of scale.
Got it. And so then you start working. Do you, like, kind of launch this with some customers, you know, while you're still doing the services business, or just how do you manage that? Because it's just hard to do. I mean, it's hard to do anything, and it's certainly hard to do two things that are very different at the same time.
Yeah, no, they're very true. That certainly was true. So, and that's why it took so long, really. So imagine we decided in 2013 we wanted to commit and build a real product, not just, you know, custom software for rebates. We did it on the side. So of our, 40 people, whatever it was, we had, four or something on the side who were kind of, and we were using the small profit we were making from the services customers to then put into this product development. And it took us, that's why it took us a couple of years to really get to our first real launchable product. And we were doing it all at the same time. So that was hard. I think what came later, which we can talk about, is when we realized that this thing had huge potential, we did understand we'd have to shut down the services business because we just couldn't possibly do both. And that was hard because we were then going from a somewhat profitable business to something which was immediately loss-making and shutting off that kind of that revenue from services. But it was the right thing to do.
Well, let's go there. I want to go back after, but let's go there because we're already on it. How far along did you get on the product in order to have the conviction to shut everything else down?
We got to 20-something customers and 2.5 million of ARR or something on the product. So that took us probably 3 or 4 years to do that. So by, say, the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, that's where we'd got to. And then the real catalyst was the Series A, because we would have just immediately gone out of business if we had shut down the thing that was generating cash when we had no capital, obviously. So but we said, look, as soon as we close the Series A, then we'll start winding up the services and we'll literally write to our customers one by one and say, unfortunately, we're shutting this down, but we're going to do it over, a year, and we'll help you to make sure you can go somewhere else.
But that's actually, that's a long time to be doing two things, 2016 to 2019. And you got pretty far along. I mean, 2.5 million ARR is pretty serious. Like, do you, just looking back, would you have done it any faster? Or do you think like that was the right way to do it?
I think I would have done it faster. I think, again, I didn't know what I didn't know, of course. And I think now that I've been in kind of the Bay Area for 4 years and done the ABCD and met lots of other CEOs, and I've now, if I'd had any of that knowledge, I probably would have done it a couple of years earlier. But probably not more than that, because we're, again, targeting quite traditional companies, manufacturers, distributors, retailers, and they're only just kind of really ready and embracing this type of product in the cloud. So if we'd been too early, I think we would have not been able to get product market fit, which I'm sure we'll be talking about.
Yeah, well, let me ask about that, right? Because I think on the road to true product market fit, I think one of the earliest things is like delivering value and just knowing whether there's even real demand. But in your case, it's so different because people were already paying you for that product, just bespoke. And all you were really doing was building it kind of so that it would be a box that you could give to everyone, kind of the same box, let's say, in simple terms. How much work did you have to do to just understand if there was real demand, or was that kind of like a given for you at that point?
You're right. I think we could see there was demand. I think we didn't know in the early days how much demand there was. And so, for example, how many industries actually had these rebates? And, was it only distributors, or would it also be other types of companies in the supply chain? And was it just the UK, or would it be other countries? So we knew there was demand, but we didn't really know how big the market was in those early days. And then I think also trying to come up with a standardized approach wasn't that straightforward, because with bespoke, you just build whatever anyone wants and you do what the customer tells you to do. Whereas with the products, you're really saying, this is how the product works, this is best practice, and no, it can't do that, but don't worry, because this is how you should do it. And then, of course, you get pushback and customers say, no, we're unique and that won't work for us. So that was still quite challenging to standardize on an approach that we could put into a product.
Well, it seems to me that might be one of the hardest parts. I'm curious if you remember any stories around building like V1 and just making the choices between, well, here's 5 or 10 different custom, iterations that we've done for these different customers. This is what we need. This is what we need. And then the debates around, why or whatever.
I mean, one of them, which was really interesting, was customers wanted to be able to get their trading partners. So that means if you're a distributor, it would be your suppliers. And if you're a manufacturer, it would be your distributors and your retailers to log in to a portal and then access certain information on the rebates and maybe approve and sign off an agreement and various things. And they all wanted a custom kind of portal that was branded for their company and where they could control the users and set the permissions. And that's what everyone wanted. And and it was actually my co-founder, so I can't take the credit for this one, David, he said, no, what we'll do is we'll have a standard portal, which will just be enable.com, and every trading partner has to register on enable. So our customers won't have like a unique portal that they control. It will just be the standard platform that everyone, and then we will effectively own the trading partners because they'll register with us, and then we'll make it many to many so that each trading partner can then see other trading partners. And that was something where I thought that will never work because customers just will refuse to do that. And when you went back to the bespoke customers, they didn't want that. But what we found was with new customers, we just explained that was how it worked. That just is how it performed. And they were like, sure, that sounds fine. So that was just one story. And that's been good because we've now got literally tens and tens of thousands of trading partners of our customers all registered directly with Enable. And it's a many-to-many kind of marketplace. So that was a really, really good design decision that we made in the product.
That's a great story. And just what brings to mind is, like, did you do any kind of classic customer discovery as you were designing V1, or did you just kind of stay, you know, you had some exposure because of what you built, and then you just kind of put your heads down and built it?
It definitely was iterative. And those early customers on the product, we did have a product, but it was very narrow. And again, one of our skills back then, and hopefully I think we do still have it, but it was a particular standout aspect back then, was actually user interface design. And again, my co-founder, David, that was his real kind of skill. So our software looked really good. And in those early days, we didn't have that much surface area, but what we did have was very kind of, had a lot of boardroom appeal, and it was you know, easier to sell. So what that meant, to answer your question, is we would get the first few customers to sign up, and then we were kind of building the product with them because, you know, we had this small surface area and we had to actually build it out as we were implementing it.
Well, what was that MVP and how did you decide what the smallest kind of, you mentioned surface area, what was the smallest thing you could build that someone you might pay for?
It was really a kind of repository of agreements. So, and a nice tools to be able to create the agreements in a structured way and you know, search them and view them and so on.
Like contracts, literally like the contract?
Yes, oh, exactly. So the rebate contracts where we'd say, right, this is between Pablo and Andrew, and there's three different line items. And first one is that I pay you 5% of all purchases and so on. So building that contract and having that in a nice repository that you could search and report on.
And before that, that would be what, like a Microsoft Word document?
Or just Excel. Yeah, exactly. And that's a good point because very early you could create, or the system would dynamically generate a PDF version of the contract from the data you put in. Whereas before, customers would have an Excel spreadsheet that they had to manually maintain, and then a Word document, to your point, of what the actual contract was. And then the two would often be different. And then I think also the calculation engine was really important. So calculating those rebates by pulling in the transactions and reconciling them with the agreements. So that probably was it. That's what we built first. And then people said, well, we need to do forecasting and we need to do cash collection and we need to do approval workflow. And these were all things we didn't have. And we had to kind of, we kind of won the customer and then basically built that out while we were implementing it.
What would you say was the main ROI of, especially that early version of the product? Like, what, why did people buy it? Was it time saving or?
It was actually better than that. It was financial return on day one, because most people weren't calculating these rebates at all or correctly. And if you're the distributor, let's say, you typically would just rely on the supplier paying you this money.
So you like rely on your boss to give you the right commission. That's kind of the, okay.
Exactly. And you don't get a statement necessarily, you just get the check and maybe it looks about right. So what we found was we could run an audit where we would take, let's say, your top 10 manufacturers, take your last 12 months of your transaction data, put all of that into Enable, and Enable would say, okay, you should have received $10 million. And then the customer would say, oh, we only got $8 million. And so we could find that missing money very, very quickly.
Those are the kind of numbers, like a few million dollars left on the table sort of thing. Is that common?
Certainly, we've seen that many, many times, yeah. And so some of our early customers, and ongoing as well, we certainly have found multi-millions in a single customer. And it's not always that much. It might be a few hundred thousand, but it does run into the millions as well.
But you're literally finding money on the table. And is that how you went into like that audit you just mentioned? Was that early on part of your sales process? Like, hey, let us run an audit and we'll show our value to you.
I mean, I think I'd probably be overstating it because we just didn't know much in those days, and we didn't really have a sales process. I think in the early days, there was just, because there was just nothing available, there was no rebate management software in the market, we were winning customers who were desperately looking, and they knew they needed it, and they knew they were missing money already, and we didn't have to sell that to them because they knew it already. And then they just found us, and then they said, wow, this is exactly what we were looking for.
I mean, this sounds like a classic kind of hair on fire problem, right? Where people, I mean, there's nothing, I would say, more compelling in B2B than when you can go to a customer and say, we will make you more money. And especially if that money's right there and you just help them literally find it. Like, it's pretty compelling. Walk me through those first 10, 20 customers. You mentioned that them coming to you. Was that really what it was? Mainly inbound? They were just finding you? And if so, how did you make yourself discoverable? I'm curious how you landed them.
Yeah, of those first few customers, you know, our first two, for example, apart from the distributor where we started and the buying group that they belonged to, did just find us on Google. And we just got Google inbound. And one of those very early ones was in the US, for example. And of course, we were not in the US and we were tiny. And I remember this company, and these are all still customers today, you know, 8, 9 years later, they would contact us and kind of say, wow, so you're not even in the US, and oh, I don't know, you know, we're a very small company, but we really like the product. We can't find anything similar in the US. So, you know, we'll sign up. But I'd say Google inbound. And then, of course, word of mouth, because when you're very, very small and you've just got a few customers, there is always some of that as well.
Well, it's something to get inbound when you're selling like consumer or SMB. It's another thing to get inbound that early on when you're selling like enterprise sales, like, you know, big contracts. Did you realize at the time how big of a signal that really was?
We probably underestimated that. And we were getting inbound for our services, of course. So we were familiar with getting inbound. But when we saw some of the UK's biggest companies literally finding us on Google and asking us for a demo, that was, yeah, we did feel, ooh, that was quite exciting.
So this is all like the good stuff. I mean, you know, I think from the outside looking in, you know, sounds like things were pretty smooth, pretty easy. Like, do you remember some of the, I'm sure it wasn't the case. Like, do you remember some of the struggles early on, you know, as you're getting those first customers, that first million or two in ARR?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and there were many of them. And I think, you know, cash flow was extremely tight, extremely tight. So I remember I would spend a lot of my time looking at the debtors list and saying, which customers can I get money out of, like, this week? And I remember I sent someone in the office to go and pick up a check from a customer because I literally couldn't make the payroll, you know, without that cash in the bank. So the cash was very, very tight. So that was one challenge.
How common was that payroll was like, you know, next week?
I mean, I'd say we were never looking more than a couple of months out. So we were, it could be a couple of weeks out, or it could be a couple of months out, or maybe three on a really good period. But you know, we were running on an overdraft, and the overdraft had covenants where we had to make a certain amount of profit, and that was tight. And so it was just, the whole thing was tight. So that was one thing. I think the other thing, to your point, is trying to juggle lots of demanding bespoke customers that kind of think they own you because they're saying, we're paying you to work by the hour to build everything we want, with trying to kind of on the side launch this product and this kind of SaaS business. That just balancing that, I think, was very challenging. And then we had plenty of technical challenges as well, where, for example, you know, one customer who, again, remains a customer today, they were one of our first and they had a lot of users and a lot of data. So they might have had, say, a million products that they wanted to load into our system. And then they might have had, say, 200 users. And we put everything in. And then all these users logged on to then start setting up all their agreements. And the whole system just sort of crashed because with that combination of volume of products and volume of users, the whole thing. I remember on a Friday, the you know, top people sort of yelling down the phone saying, this has to be fixed by Monday because we've got all these people allocated to put this on. And this is a disaster. And my technical guys were saying, this is going to take about 6 weeks to fix. We've got to like rewrite aspects, not the whole system, but certain things have to be kind of rewritten. So that type of thing certainly came up. So those are some of the...
How did you resolve that one?
Just real careful client management, really. So just, I think, over-communicating. I literally got in my car and drove to their offices and walked around and showed interest and said, yeah, you know, this is very serious, and we had like daily conference calls, and they were patient as well. But so, you know, they could have easily just pulled the plug and said, forget this, it's no good. But I think just trying to manage it day by day, really. What was exciting was seeing the common ground. So there certainly were areas where, you know, we would get pushback and customers would say, we're unique and we need it this way, and we'd try and convince them that the way we were doing it was better and explain why. But what was starting to happen was in different locations, so let's say US and UK, and different industries, so say electrical and automotive parts and construction, we found that actually the way that they managed their rebates had a lot of similarities and a lot of the similar challenges. And so we were using the same product and the same code base to supply customers in those different industries. And then we found, for example, that those customers wanted to invite their trading partners to use Enable with them, because if you've got, it's always at least a two-sided agreement. So if you've got both sides looking at it together on the same web page, then that's hugely helpful to make it effective. And so manufacturers would then come in and say, well, actually, we need this as well. We're actually struggling to manage it from our perspective. So that was really encouraging when we could see, you know, common ground in different industries, different countries, different company types, and made us realize this was a big problem.
Maybe what I'd like to end on actually is, you know, you mentioned running on cash flow and maybe a little bit of debt, and that being obviously really challenging. And then at some point you raise a very large Series A. I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe $17 million. What was that process like of raising that round? Walk me through that. And I'm curious also what it must have felt like having gone so long bootstrapping and then finding yourself with that much money in the bank.
It was $17 million of Series A in total, you're right. But on day one, which was February 2020, it was, I think it was 12. And then because the pandemic hit and we had other people that were interested, then we kind of just extended it, and it eventually got to 17. So that's just one point. I would say the Series A was the most difficult of all of the rounds. So we were very fortunate that the B, C and D were kind of all preempted. So really investors came to us, and it was, whereas the Series A was really me, a couple of my team knocking on doors. And of course, no one had ever heard of Enable. We were this strange, and you can imagine the pattern recognition was not there, because we were this UK company that kind of had services, and then we built this thing, and it was all very odd. You know, it wasn't what Silicon Valley expects or what they normally look for. And I was virtually on like a tourist visa, you know, in the Bay Area.
Did you go down there? I'm actually curious, like beginning to end, yes, the whole process, how you thought about it, how you set it up.
So I guess this one fun story is I was a member of a CEO group in the UK called Vistage, and that's still around today. And it started in the US, and it's sort of like a peer group for CEOs. And I was in that peer group, and we'd meet every month and compare challenges and opportunities. And I presented to this group in mid 2018. And I said, look, I'm at a crossroads, because I've got this services business that's steadily growing and it's kind of profitable. Then I've got this product, which is a huge opportunity, but it will lose money for years and it might fail. But I can only do one. I need to focus. And everyone said, you have to do the product. But one person in the room said, if you want to do this seriously, you need to move to California. And he said, you know, they know how to build software companies there. And I thought back to that study tour, and I thought, good point. So I went home to my wife in June 2018 and said, how do you feel about moving to California? And she was like, yep, yeah, we should, let's do it. So we then, to get back on your question, we then contacted the guy that led the study tour several years before and said, would you take us back and introduce us to some VCs? So we met some VCs. And we weren't raising, but we were just learning about what Silicon Valley was looking for.
You'd already made the move, by the way, or you were still thinking it through?
No. So this was just like a month or two after contemplating that we might move. So, and what was happening was we'd got by then, let's say, $1 million of ARR or something, but it was growing slowly because we hadn't got any, you know, we were not focusing on it. And what was clear is we would have to have a really good growth rate at the point we closed the Series A. So I then had to basically divert resources between the services company and the product company and accelerate that growth. And that took about a year. So there were a couple of visits backwards and forwards to the Bay Area, kind of planning things. And then it was November 2019 that we were just about to move. We were about to make the move. You know, we'd got our lease signed on an apartment and so on. And we were meeting investors for real. And I met a bunch of investors and said to them, I'm going to be here in January full time, but I'm just showing you what we're doing. If you're interested, let's meet again in January. And that's that. And then we actually got here, you know, December, January time. But part of that story was a lot of the investors weren't interested, obviously, as always. But there were a couple who were, And they didn't want to wait. So they said, look, we want to do this now. And in the end, we actually signed the term sheet with Menlo Ventures, who led the Series A, before we physically arrived in San Francisco.
What did they see? Because again, did they understand the space, or what was it from their vantage point that made them excited?
Well, I mean, I think they were very smart individuals, and they didn't understand the space because there wasn't really a space. You know, no one else was doing this. So I don't think they'd seen this before, but something resonated with them. Part of it was the network effect that I've mentioned, where you win a customer and then they want to bring all their partners with them, and then they have other partners and so on. So that was part of the interest. And so we just got their curiosity, and they were impressed with the numbers because, like you say, getting to a couple of million while bootstrapping was unusual.
And you had gone from about a million to what, 2.5 in that year?
That was the type of thing. So they then took some time to do some diligence and to make some calls and speak to some customers, and they were like, oh, actually, this does sound really interesting. But they had that vision, which most of the other investors didn't have back then.
How did it feel like when you closed that round, and did you feel like, whoa, I can breathe all of a sudden?
Yeah, no. I mean, it was hugely exciting to go from, you know, a couple of weeks or a couple of months of visibility to a couple of years plus of visibility in one day. You know, that was huge. So I remember the day of the close, it was actually February the 19th, 2020. We had an all hands meeting that day, and we announced to the whole company, look, this is now closed. We've gone from, you know, a few weeks of breathing room to a few years of breathing room. And, you know, now we've got the fuel to really drive and focus on this. And we're not going to be beholden to the services work where we just have to do whatever anyone wants us to do. We can actually drive our own agenda. So that was huge. And I remember originally thinking if we could raise 10 million, that would kind of keep us going forever. You know, we'd never raise any more. So the crazy thing now, as you pointed out, is we've now gone on and raised significantly more than that. And I think the investment required to build a sort of significant global company is probably higher than most people realize, and certainly higher than, I think some people are more clever and they can do it with a lot less money. But for me, it has been more expensive than I first anticipated.
Yeah, I mean, you've raised nearly $300 million now. So
correct.
Congrats. By the way, one more question on that. Do you remember any, like, especially having, you know, being your first go round really fundraising, you remember any particular meetings, rejections? We're all used to getting no's as founders, but every now and then there's just something that hits a little harder. Maybe they pinpoint something that's a little bit more of a doubt in your mind, and you're like, I wonder if they're right.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think one of the things is implementing our system fully does take a bit of time because we're connecting to the customer's ERP system usually, and we're pulling in all their transactions, and then we're pulling in all their master data, and, you know, most people's data quality is low. It's not like a Dropbox or a Slack where you can sign up and then on day one, you're using the product and recognizing revenue. This is more where you have to implement it over a period of a few months. And I think one of the big questions was, can that really scale? You know, can you really get, say, 1,000 customers? Because if it takes a few months to implement each one, then how does that scale? So I think that was a good kind of pushback, which I thought I wasn't sure we'd be able to overcome.
So we'll stop it there. And I'll just end on the two questions that we always end on. The first one is, when did you feel like you had true product market fit?
Yeah. So I think probably a couple of moments, really. The first one, I think, was once we had, say, a dozen independent customers that weren't associated with each other in any way, and they weren't like friends and family. They were, you know, unique kind of companies that had encountered us, or we'd encountered them, and we had them all live on the product on the same code base. Then that was a really good feeling of, this isn't just some system we've written for a couple of companies or that we've persuaded someone to use. We've actually got, you know, 10 or 12 distinct companies all running on the same code and getting value and renewing their first year, that type of thing. So I think that would be a big marker. But then I think the other one was after I came out here to the Bay Area, and we hired an amazing revenue leader, a guy called Jerry Bruner, who's with us, still with us today. And he started to build the go-to-market and get real kind of customer velocity, where we were signing up, you know, 5, 10, 15, 25, 30 new customers per quarter. Then that also, you know, because originally we were signing up a customer every now and then. And at the point where we were doing, say, 25 customers a quarter net new, then that definitely was a clear clear signal.
Awesome. And then the last question is, if you could take everything you've learned through your journey at Enable and go back to your younger self when you were just starting in 2015, 2016 with one piece of advice, what might that be?
I think it probably is to focus. If you can really go deep and understand something well, understand one use case which is impactful, and then build something and create the messaging around something which is very targeted and, you know, very deep for that use case, and then go and raise money and go and, you know, focus on that. That's the great way to do it. And most of us, and I was in this camp, just go way too broad. We build out way too much. We do too many things, and we try and do, and then almost thinking that, you know, maybe one of them will succeed. But I think you can never be too focused, really. And that's something I still question myself on today.
Perfect. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. Appreciate you sharing your journey. I look forward to seeing your stock ticker on Yahoo Finance in the coming years. But anyways, it was a great episode. I'm sure founders will get a lot from your story.
Okay, well, thanks for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
If you listen to this episode and the show and you like it, I have a huge favor to ask for you. Well, it's actually a really small favor, but it has huge impact. But whichever app you're listening to this episode on, take it out, go to a Product Market Fit show, and leave a review, please. It's going to help. It's not just going to help me, to be clear. It's going to help other founders discover the show, because the algorithms, whether it's Spotify, whether it's Apple, whether it's any other podcast player, one of the big things they look at is frequency of reviews. It's quantity of reviews. And the reality is, if all of you listening right now left reviews, we would have thousands of reviews. So please take literally a minute, even if you're just writing like, great podcast, or I love this podcast, whatever it is, just write a few words. Obviously, the longer the better, the more detailed the better, but write anything, leave 5 stars, and you will be helping me, but most importantly, many other founders just like you discover the show. Thank you.